legal thresholds like, I feared for the safety of myself and others, held no meaning. They were not evidence of anything. The jury delivered its verdict based on evidence never shared outside the confines of the guilty mind. Inside, Ballard knew that Thomas Trent, no matter the size and content of his evil, should still be alive. The thought of Trent's death gave way to the unanswered questions. How did he know she was a cop? How did he find her in Ventura? The fact that he had turned against Beatrice Beaupre in the end told Ballard that she was not the source. She once again reviewed, as well as she could remember, her conversations with Trent at the car dealership, during the test drive and while she was driving to Ventura. She recalled nothing that could have revealed her as a law enforcement officer. She wondered if it had been the firm handshake she had used to elicit a response of pain in him. Was that the tell? Or was it her questions about the bruises that followed? She then thought about the van. Trent had seen the van when she pulled into the dealership. Had he somehow been able to run the plate and get her true identity and the address of the house in Ventura? He worked at a car dealership, where DMV transactions were carried out dozens of times every day. Perhaps Trent had a source, a friendly DMV clerk who registered new plates and had access to the registrations on existing ones. During the abduction, Trent spoke about her tan lines and her ethnic origins, revealing a fascination with her that was established during the dealership visit. Maybe, Ballard realized, Trent began stalking her because she was an intended target, not because she was a cop targeting him. Again, the bottom line was that Trent was dead. Ballard might never get an answer to her questions. She didn't notice that the water had gradually turned cold until her body began to shake with chills. Only then did she get up and get out. Lola sat dutifully at the door of the bathroom. Come on, girl. Ballard padded down the hallway to her room in bare feet, a large white towel wrapped around her body. She closed the door to her bedroom and noticed that Tutu had finished the laundry she had started the night before in the garage. Her clothes were neatly folded on the bed, and Ballard was overjoyed at the prospect of putting on fresh and clean things. She put on a bra and underwear. But before getting dressed further, she checked her phone, which was charging on the bedside table where she had left it. The screen said she had 11 new voicemail messages. She sat on the bed and started playing them one by one. The first two messages were from Jenkins, and had been left before they had connected at the crime scene. He had gotten word about the investigation into an officer-involved death on Wrightwood Drive, and wanted to know if she was okay. The second message was to let her know that he was going to the crime scene to find her. The next message was from an academy classmate Ballard maintained ties with. Rose Baccio heard on the Blue Pipeline that Ballard was at the center of an officer-involved death being investigated in Studio City. Balls! She said, using Ballard's Academy nickname. Thank God you're all right. Call me. We need to talk. The fourth message was similar. It was from Corey Stedman of RHD, another friend hoping Ballard was okay. The fifth caller was Rob Compton, parole agent and sometime lover. He evidently was not aware of what was going on with Ballard and was not calling about her abduction or killing of Thomas Trent. Hey, Renee, it's Robbie. Listen, we got a hot one. An ATF agent called me about the stolen Glock we recovered from our boy Nettles. Pretty interesting stuff. Hit me back, okay? It took Ballard a moment to place what Compton was talking about. The events of the past day had been so acute that they had completely crowded other cases and memories from her mind. Then she remembered. Christopher Nettles. The one-man crime wave. Compton had put in an ATF request on the three presumed stolen weapons recovered from Nettles and his room at the Siesta Village Motel. Ballard made a mental note to call Compton as soon as she got into the proper mental state to work cases. She thought that diving back into the Nettles caper would be a welcome diversion from her current situation. The next message was from her direct supervisor, Lieutenant McAdams. He opened by telling Ballard he was relieved to hear that she was reasonably okay after the ordeal. That said, he began reading an order that had come to him from on high that put Ballard on light duty while the investigation of the officer-involved death proceeded. So, I'm working on the schedule, and I'll get somebody paired up with Jenkins, McAdams concluded after reading the order. You're riding the pine on Dayside until FID finishes up, and you get the all-clear from BSU. It's all pretty routine. Give me a call back or shoot me an email to let me know you received and understand this order. Thanks, Renee. The next couple of messages were from well-wishers within the department. One of those was Roger's car, a of major crimes. This is Carr. And wow, I just heard. Glad you're okay. Glad you're good. And glad you took that big evil out of the picture. I'm around if you need anything. Ballard had been deleting the messages as she heard them, but she saved the recording from Carr. She thought she might want to listen to it again, especially the part about taking Big Evil out of the picture. She thought that the message might be reassuring to listen to the next time her internal jury started deliberating the case and leaning toward a guilty verdict. The next message was also a keeper. It was from Beatrice Beaupré. She was crying, as she had left it just an hour earlier. "They finally let me go. They asked a lot of questions, and then they asked them all over again. Anyway, Detective Ballard, I told them the truth. You saved my life. You saved both our lives. He was going to kill me. I know it. He told me so when he injected me. I thought that was it. Then you were there to save me. You were so good. You fought him and got the upper hand. I told them. I told them what I saw. Thank you, Detective Ballard. Thank you so much." Her voice trailed off into a sob as Beatrice hung up. The message, though heartfelt, gave Ballard pause. She knew Beatrice had not seen the fight with Trent. She was unconscious. The message indicated she had told the FID investigators she had seen what she hadn't. Had Beatrice perceived that the FID was trying to fault Ballard in some way and turn it into a bad killing? She had to be careful here. She couldn't call Beaupré back to inquire about these concerns. That might be viewed by the FID as witness tampering. It was a firing offense to try to manipulate an internal investigation. Ballard had to bide her time and be cautious. The call from Beatrice was a good heads up. Her feelings of concern seemed more than justified when she got the last two messages. The first of these was from Lieutenant Feltzer of FID. He was requesting that they move up the hour of their appointment for a follow-up interview. He said that the crime scene investigation had been completed and all initial interviews were conducted. "We need to sit down with you and iron out the inconsistencies," he said. "Please come to the FID office tomorrow morning at, let's say, 8 o'clock. We'll try to get you out of here as soon as possible." The first thing Ballard thought about was whether she should bring a union defense rep with her to FID. She had picked up an adversarial tone in Feltzer's voice, and given the message from Beatrice, she was growing more concerned the more she thought about what Feltzer had said about inconsistencies. Then it struck her. Her choice for a defense rep would have been Ken Chastain. He was smart. His analytical mind could have helped her decipher the moves being made against her. He would have been perfect in helping her form her answers to their questions. But he had betrayed her, and now he was dead. She had no one she felt comfortable asking to sit next to her. No one close. No one smart and cunning enough. Not Jenkins. Not Stedman. She was alone against this. If that conclusion wasn't depressing enough, the last message on her phone was the true chiller. It had come in less than 30 minutes ago, while she had been in the shower. The caller was a reporter from the Times named Jerry Castor. Ballard had never spoken to him, but he was known to her. She had seen him at various crime scenes and press conferences, especially during her time with RHD. Reading the Times coverage of the department over time gave insight to the allegiances of different reporters. The angles the stories took often revealed the sources, even if unnamed, behind them. Castor was considered a Level 8 reporter by those in the department who monitored such things. This was a reference to the makeup of the PAB. The building was 10 floors, with command staff and administration largely housed on floors 8 through 10, with the chief on top. It was believed that Castor was a reporter more plugged in on the three upper floors than on the seven below. It made dealing with him more career dangerous for the rank and file than with other reporters. That was one reason Ballard had always steered clear of him. "Detective Ballard, Jerry Castor over at the Times," his message began. "We haven't met, but I cover the cop shop, and I'm working on a story over here about the death of Thomas Trent. I really need to talk to you about it today. My main question is about the fatal injuries Mr. Trent sustained. As I understand it, this man was unarmed and not charged with any crime, but he ended up getting stabbed multiple times, and I'm curious to know if you care to comment on how that figures in with justifiable use of deadly force. My first deadline is 8 o'clock tonight, so I'm hoping to hear from you by then. If not, the story will reflect our unsuccessful efforts to reach you for your side of things." Castor thanked her, left his direct number in the newsroom, and hung up. What felt like a punch to Ballard's gut wasn't the reporter calling her out in terms of the deadly force. At the academy, they don't teach you to shoot once when you need to fire your weapon. If deadly force is warranted, you use deadly force in whatever quantity is necessary to get the job done. Legally and departmentally, whether she stabbed Trent 4 times or only once didn't matter. What got to Ballard was that someone inside the department had told the reporter the details of the killing and pushed them out into the uninformed public space. Someone had called Castor, knowing that the details provided would be cause for debate and vilification. She felt like she had been cut loose from the department and was on her own. There was a knock on the bedroom door.
Renee? I'm getting dressed. I'll be out in a minute. Honey, I'm making fish tonight. I got some barramundi fresh from Australia. I hope you can stay. Tutu, I told you, just because they call it fresh doesn't mean it's fresh. How can anything be fresh if it's packed in dry ice and flown or shipped all the way from Australia? Stick with stuff you know is fresh. Halibut from the bay.
There was silence, and Ballard felt like shit for taking out the frustrations of the moment on her grandmother. She started dressing quickly.
Does that mean you don't want to stay? Tutu asked through the door. I'm really sorry, but it's a work night and they're calling me in early, Ballard said. I need to pick up a rental car and go soon. Oh, sweetie, you've been through so much. Can't you take the night off? Tutu asked. I'll cook something else.
Ballard finished buttoning her blouse.
It's not about the fish, she said. Cook your fish, Tutu. But I can't stay, I'm sorry. Are you okay with Lola here for a couple more days?
She opened the door. Her tiny grandmother stood there, worry clearly on her face. Lola is always welcome here, she said. She's my buddy, but I want her owner here, too. Ballard reached out and hugged her, holding her in a fragile embrace.
Soon, she said. I promise.
Ballard didn't like lying to her grandmother, but the full and honest explanation was too complicated. She had to get back to the city. Not only did she have the session with Feltzer the next morning, and the psych exam to follow, but she knew that she couldn't fight this battle from up in Ventura. She had to get to Ground Zero to make her stand. Chapter 30. Most people were trying to get out of L.A. Ballard was trying to get in. She steadily goosed her rented Ford Taurus through heavy rush hour traffic on the 101 freeway toward downtown. The miles went by slowly. She feared she would miss the 8 o'clock deadline at the Times. She had devised a plan that she believed might give her the upper hand against those working against her in the department. She knew a couple things about how the murky lines between the media and law enforcement were negotiated. She knew there was little cooperation and even little trust. Those who chose to cross those murky lines guarded against risks. It was that practice that she was going to use to her own purposes. The PAB and the Times building sat side by side on First Street, with only Spring Street separating them. The two giant bureaucracies cast jaundiced eyes at each other, yet at times they certainly needed each other. Ballard finally got to the area at 7:20 and parked in an overpriced pay lot behind the newspaper building. She took a shoulder bag containing some of her clean clothes with her and walked to the coffee shop on Spring Street that offered a clear view from its corner window of the blocked long stretch of road that separated the newspaper and police buildings. Once situated with a cup of coffee at the counter behind the corner window, Ballard pulled her phone and called Jerry Castor on his direct newsroom line. This is Renee Ballard.
Oh, hi. I'm glad you called. There's still time for me to get your comments into the story.
I'm not giving you any comments. This conversation is off the record.
Well, I was hoping to get some reaction to what I'm saying in my story, which is,
I'm not giving reaction. I'm not giving comments. And I don't care what you say in your story. I'm hanging up now unless you agree that this conversation is off the record. There was a long silence.
Okay. We're off the record, Castor finally said. For now, at least. I just don't understand why you wouldn't want to get your side of it into the story.
Are you recording this? Ballard asked.
No, I'm not recording.
Well, just so you know,
I am.
I've been recording since the start of the call. Are you okay with that?
I guess so, but I don't see why you...
You'll understand in a few minutes. So that is a yes on recording?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Mr. Castor, I'm calling to tell you that your information is wrong.
that you're being manipulated by your LAPD sources to put out a story that is not only wrong, but designed to inflict harm upon me and others. Harm? How is that? If you tell a lie in your paper, that harms me. You need to go back to your sources and take a look at their motives and ask them for the truth. Are you saying you didn't stab Thomas Trent multiple times? That your statement was contradicted by another victim's statement? That second part was new information, and it would be helpful to Ballard. I'm saying you've been lied to, and I have this conversation on tape, Ballard said. If you proceed with that story and its lies and out-of-context statements, then this recording, with its direct warning, will go to your editor and other media outlets, so it will become clear in your community and in your workplace what kind of reporter you are and what kind of newspaper The Times is. Good night, Mr. Castor. Wait, Castor cried. Ballard disconnected and waited, keeping her eyes on the Spring Street employee entrance of The Times. She was working off a fact, a supposition, and an assumption. The fact was that it was against the law and the policy of the LAPD to publicly disclose the details of a personnel investigation. Ballard had killed a man that morning in the line of duty. That was news, and the department was duty-bound to inform the public. That came in the form of a press release all parties had agreed upon. Ballard and Feltzer had written the 3-paragraph statement while they had been in the command post that morning. But Ballard had not agreed to releasing any more details of the killing or the subsequent investigation. Castor obviously had details that went beyond the press release. It meant he had a source who was feeding him those details in violation of the law and department policy. Ballard's supposition was that Castor's source would be smart and cagey and would be sure not to place himself in a position where he could be compromised. He would certainly not reveal the details of a personnel investigation in a phone call that could be recorded or heard by others without his knowledge. Whatever motivated a source to spill to the newspaper, the actual leaking would be clandestine and not take place on the phone, in the newspaper office, or at the LAPD. That led to the assumption Ballard had just thrown a fastball at Castor, and she guessed he would run, figuratively, in a panic to his source in order to salvage the story. He needed to tell his source what Ballard had just said. If there were ground rules about not talking on a phone, then Castor would be walking out of the Times building at any moment to head to a meeting with his source. Ballard's only worry was that the reporter's secret spot for meeting his source might be the very coffee shop where she was now sitting. It would be perfectly reasonable for a reporter from the Times building and a LAPD employee from the PAB to cross paths in a coffee shop equidistant from both their work locations. Words and documents could be exchanged in the line to order, at the waiting counter after ordering, or at the sugar and cream stand. Ballard visually tracked one man for half a block after he stepped through the Times door and headed north and away from her. After finally deciding he was a bogey, her eyes returned to the building's doors just in time to see the real Jerry Castor emerge. He turned south, passing by the coffee shop from the other side of Spring Street. Ballard dumped the coffee she had bought but hadn't even tasted. She stepped out onto the sidewalk and headed south, tracking Castor from the other side of the street. There was a time when following someone on foot at night in downtown L.A. would have been impossible to pull off because of the scarcity of pedestrians after the 9-to-5 workday ended. But the district had begun to thrive in recent years, with many young professionals deciding to avoid the angst of killer traffic and live in the area where they worked. Restaurants and nightlife soon followed. On this night near 8 p.m., Ballard had no problem keeping other pedestrians between herself and Castor, though it did not appear that the reporter was thinking about the possibility of a tail. He never looked behind himself once. He never cleverly glanced into the reflection of a shop's plate glass window. He walked swiftly and with purpose, like a man on a mission, or on a deadline. Castor led Ballard south for 4 blocks until he got to the corner of 5th Street, and then took a right and disappeared through an open door. Ballard wondered if it was a move designed to lose a tail, but as she caught up, she saw a neon sign that announced the business as The Last Bookstore. Ballard entered cautiously, and found a giant bookstore in a space that appeared to have formerly been the grand lobby of a bank. There were rows of freestanding bookshelves angled between Corinthian columns, rising 2 stories, to an ornate coffered ceiling. On one wall hung a sculpture of books forming a wave. Balconies fronting small art and used record shops offered a view down onto the main floor, which was crowded with customers. Ballard had no idea of the place's existence, and the excitement of the find almost made her forget her quarry. Using a set of shelves, dedicated to the classics as a partial blind, Ballard scanned the lower level of the bookstore, looking for Castor. The reporter was nowhere to be seen, and it was impossible to cover every corner of the space because of the shelves, columns, and other obstacles to her vision. Ballard saw a man with a name tag pinned to his shirt, walking toward the checkout counter near the door. "Excuse me," she said. "How do I get upstairs?" "I'll show you real quick," the man said. He walked Ballard over to an alcove that had been hidden from her sight and pointed to a set of stairs. She thanked him and quickly started up. The upper-level balconies afforded Ballard a fuller view of the bookstore below. There were several reading alcoves created by shelf stands, positioned at right angles and complete with old leather chairs or couches in the privacy spots. It was the perfect place for a clandestine meeting. Ballard scanned the whole place twice before finally spotting Castor in an alcove almost directly below her. He was sitting on the edge of a couch, leaning forward, and in animated but quiet conversation with another man. It took a moment for the other man to turn his face so that Ballard could clearly see it. It was Lieutenant Feltzer. Ballard didn't know whether to be more outraged by Feltzer's treachery or jubilant that she knew who the leak was and could do something about it. She pulled her phone and surreptitiously took several photos of the meeting below. At one point, she switched to video when Castor stood up like he was in a hurry and looked down at Feltzer. He waved his hands in a dismissive way, and then walked out of the alcove and crossed the main floor of the store. Ballard kept the camera going, tracking the reporter until he left the store through the door he had used to enter. When Ballard brought the camera back across the floor to the alcove where Feltzer had been sitting, he was gone. She lowered the phone and scanned the store as best she could. There was no sign of Feltzer. Ballard suddenly became concerned that Feltzer had seen her and that he was on his way up to the second level. She turned to the steps, but she saw nobody coming up. She was safe. Feltzer must have left the store, taking a different route through the maze of shelves and then out the door. Ballard went down to the main floor, watching for Feltzer but catching no glimpse of him. She exited the store onto Fifth and looked about. No sign of Feltzer. Ballard guessed that Feltzer, like Castor, had walked to the meeting, but that he had passed the same four blocks via Main Street instead of Spring. Main was more convenient from the PAB's exit, and it put space between the reporter and his source. She saw the light at the intersection change and crossed, then followed Fifth to Main Street. At the intersection, she casually looked around the corner and north on Main. There, about two blocks away in the direction of the PAB, she saw a man walking with a fast pace that she recognized as Feltzer's hard-charging gait. Concerned that Feltzer would be more alert than Castor to the possibility of a tail, Ballard waited another 10 minutes before heading up Main herself. When she got to First, she turned right and walked down into Little Tokyo. At the Mayako Hotel, she checked into a room after being assured by the desk clerk that there were several sushi choices on the room service menu. She got to the room and ordered dinner first thing. Then she opened her shoulder bag and laid out the clothes she planned to wear in the morning. The meeting with Feltzer was going to be pivotal. While she waited for her food, she pulled out her phone and Googled the business number for defense attorney Dean Towson. She expected Towson wouldn't be in his office this late, but he would most likely get her message. Defense attorneys were used to getting late-night calls from clients, and judging by how fearful Towson had grown by the end of Ballard's interview with him Sunday morning, he would return the call promptly. The call went through to an answering service, and Ballard spoke to a live individual instead of a computer. "My name is Detective Renee Ballard with the LAPD. I spoke to Mr. Towson Sunday morning about a murder investigation. Please get a message to Mr. Towson tonight. I need him to call me back as soon as possible, no matter how late. This is urgent." She disconnected and began to wait. To pass the time, she put on the room's television and was soon distracted by the political infighting and name-calling presented every night on cable TV. Towson's callback came faster than the sushi. Chapter 31. At 8:25 a.m. Wednesday morning, Ballard walked into the FID offices at PAB with Dean Towson. It had been Towson's idea to arrive late and to ignore Lieutenant Feltzer's two calls and messages to Ballard, asking where she was. It put Feltzer on edge before they even got there. As head of one of the unit's two squads, Feltzer had a private office. It was small and they had to wheel a chair in to accommodate Towson. He and Ballard sat across the desk from a visibly annoyed lieutenant, who had closed the door.
Detective Ballard, I'm not sure why you see the need to have an attorney present, Feltzer said. You are still subject to Liebarger and are compelled to answer questions. If anything criminal arises out of this investigation, then of course, all statements from you will be disallowed.
He raised his hands off his desk in a gesture that suggested this was simple stuff, and they did not need a lawyer to complicate it.
I intend to fully cooperate and answer all questions, Ballard said, but only if I have my attorney present.
You said in your message that we needed to clear up some inconsistencies. Why don't we do that and not worry about my having representation?
Feltzer considered it, clearly looking like a man worried about walking into a legal trap of some kind.
We're going to record this, he finally said, as with the first interview. He opened a desk drawer and got out a digital recorder. As he was setting it to record, Towson removed his phone from the inside pocket of his suit coat and put it on the desk.
We'll be recording the session as well, he said.
Whatever floats your boat, Feltzer said.
Thank you, Towson said.
Let's start with the other victim, Beatrice Beaupré, Feltzer said. In your statement yesterday, you said that she was unconscious when she was brought into the room by Trent.
I believe I said she appeared to be unconscious, Ballard said.
My focus was on Trent, not her.
Miss Beaupré had told us that she was in fact conscious at the time, and was pretending not to be so that she might have a chance of escaping from Trent.
Okay, that's entirely possible.
She goes on to say that she saw you and Trent engage in the struggle that resulted in his fatal injuries, and her description of what happened differs markedly from yours.
Well, she would definitely have had a different view of it.
I'm giving you the chance to correct the record if you wish.
I would just defer to Miss Beaupré's account. I was engaged at the time in a life-or-death struggle with a man nearly twice my weight and size. I wasn't stopping to take notes or commit my moves to memory. I was trying to stay alive and to keep Miss Beaupré alive as well.
It was an answer Ballard and Towson had rehearsed, because they assumed that the discrepancies Feltzer alluded to in his phone message were the contradictions between her and Beaupré's statements.
Ballard and Towson had met at 6:30 that morning, in the breakfast room at the Mayako Hotel, to prepare for the FID appointment. The rehearsed response covered all contradictions with the threshold factor and justified homicide. Fear of death or great bodily harm to the officer or citizenry.
I think that covers it, Lieutenant, Towson said. Do you have anything else for my client?
Feltzer looked at Towson.
Yes, I do, he said.
There was a confidence in Feltzer's voice that put Ballard on high alert.
Have you had any communication with Miss Beaupré since the incident occurred and you two were separated for questioning? Feltzer asked.
Nothing direct, Ballard said.
She called my cell phone yesterday, and I didn't take the call. She left a message thanking me for saving her life. I haven't responded to the call yet because I thought it would be inappropriate to speak with her before your investigation is concluded.
Another carefully crafted and rehearsed answer.
I still have the message, Ballard said. I could put it on speaker and play it for the recording if you wish.
We'll get to that later if we need to, Feltzer said. Your late arrival has backed me into other appointments, so let's move on.
Yesterday, you said that when you managed to free yourself while Trent was gone, you did not immediately leave the house because you were not sure where you were and whether you could escape.
Is that fair to say?
We are talking about a very brief moment, Ballard said.
Those were my thoughts initially, but then I heard the garage door, and I knew that Trent was back and that he most likely had another victim with him because he told me he was going to abduct his ex-wife.
But your initial answer indicates you had no idea where you were.
Well, I certainly assumed I was in Trent's house, and I knew where he lived because I had backgrounded him when he became a person of interest in my investigation.
Had you ever previously been in that house?
There it was. Feltzer had information he hadn't had when he questioned her the day before.
No, I had never been inside that house, Ballard said.
She had to assume that the two North Hollywood patrol officers she had met on Wrightwood on Friday night had come forward.
Had you ever been on the premises of Thomas Trent's home? Feltzer asked.
Yes, I had been on the premises, Ballard answered without hesitation.
Towson leaned slightly forward. He was now flying blind. Ballard had not discussed at breakfast her attempt to ghost Trent's house, because she had no idea it would come up.
Towson now had to trust that Ballard knew how to navigate this set of questions.
How so, Detective Ballard? Feltzer asked.
On Friday evening, I confirmed that Trent was at his job, at the car dealership, and I went to his house to look around, Ballard said. My victim had described being taken to an upside-down house. I felt it was important to see if Trent's home matched that description. Detective, did you call in a false report of a prowler on Wrightwood Drive in order to facilitate this look-around? Towson put his hand on Ballard's arm to stop her from responding. She's not going to answer that, he said. This is a use-of-force investigation. We're not going to discuss unrelated matters. It is related, Feltzer said. My information is that Detective Ballard on Friday night was on the porch outside of the room where she was later allegedly held captive and where she killed Thomas Trent. She said in her statement that she didn't know where she was and couldn't escape. That is in conflict with the facts I have accumulated. Being outside a room and being inside a room are completely different, Towson countered. My client had been assaulted, drugged, and possibly raped, all of which affected her perceptions. The curtains were closed, Ballard added. I didn't know I was in a room off that porch. Towson waved a hand in a dismissive manner. This doesn't fly, Lieutenant, he said. You are wasting our time. There is clearly an agenda here. You are attempting to build a case to dismiss Detective Ballard for reasons that don't exist. She didn't escape. She stayed back and risked her life to save another. Are you seriously trying to make this count against her? Where does this come from? There is no agenda here, Feltzer said. And I strenuously object to your characterization of this investigation. You are completely out of line. You want to talk about what's out of line? Towson said. This is what's out of line. The lawyer opened his briefcase, took out a folded A section of the morning's Los Angeles Times, and dropped it on the desk. The story on the Trent killing had caught the bottom corner of the front page. The story was bylined with Jerry Castor's name. I have nothing to do with what the media reports, Feltzer said. I have no say in how complete or incomplete the story is. Bullshit, Ballard said. This story includes details that go far beyond the official press release put out yesterday by the department, Towson said. Not only that, but the release of selective details and the omission of others puts my client in an unfavorable light. It's a hit piece. We'll look into how the Times came to have their information, Feltzer said. That's hardly reassuring when the investigator is probably the one who leaked it, Towson said. I warn you, sir, Feltzer said angrily. I will put up with a lot from you, but I'm not going to allow you to assault my reputation. I play by the rules here. Feltzer's face grew red with anger. He was putting on a credible show. He was also playing directly into Ballard and Towson's hands. Your anger indicates that you would agree that the leaking of details outside the agreed-upon press release is a violation of Detective Ballard's privacy rights under the law and the policy of this department, Towson said. I told you, we are going to look into the leak, Feltzer said. Why? Towson said. Was it illegal or just not fair? It was against the law, okay? Feltzer said. We will investigate. Towson pointed toward Feltzer's computer screen. Well, Lieutenant, we'd like to help with that investigation, he said. Let me give you a link to pull up. What are you talking about? Feltzer said. What link? It's a website that we will be directing LAPD command staff and local media to at a press conference later today, Towson said. It's jerryandjoe.com. Pull up your server and check it out. Feltzer's computer screen was on a side extension to his desk, so that it would not be a visible barrier between him and anyone sitting across the main desk from him. He turned now and activated the screen. He pulled up his server and started typing in the website address. Jerry, with a J, Ballard said, as in Jerry Castor. Feltzer paused for a moment, his fingers hovering over the keyboard. It's okay, Lieutenant, Towson said. It's just a website. Feltzer typed. The website opened on his screen. It was a single page with a 9-second video playing in a loop, a downward view of Feltzer meeting with Jerry Castor at the last bookstore the night before. Towson had hatched the idea for the site at breakfast and had bought the domain and set it up while he and Ballard were eating. Feltzer watched the video in stunned silence. After the third loop, he killed the screen. He was turned away from Ballard and Towson, so neither one of them could fully see the look on his face. But his head bowed, as he obviously considered his predicament. In seconds, he determined that the timestamp video spoke for itself, and that his situation was untenable. Like the political animal the video revealed him to be, he slowly turned back to Ballard and Towson, a look on his face that was somewhere between panic and acceptance of dire consequences. "So what do you want?" he said. Ballard was elated. Their plan to corner Feltzer had worked flawlessly. "We want this obvious effort to drive Detective Ballard from the department to stop right here," Towson said. He waited, and Feltzer nodded once, almost unnoticeably. "And we want another story on the Times website by 6 p.m. tonight, and in the hard copy tomorrow morning," Towson continued. "We want fuller details leaked to your friend Jerry Castor, details that put Detective Ballard in the positive light she deserves. I want to see words like hero and in policy and justified in the story." "I can't control how they write," Feltzer protested. "You know that." "Try, Lieutenant," Towson said. "Your friend Castor has just as much reason as you to set the record straight. He won't look good if this comes out in some of the media around town. He'll look like the shill for LAPD management that he is, and I don't think the editors across the street will like that." "Okay, okay," Feltzer said. "That it?" "No, not even close," Ballard said. "I want access to Trent's house, and access to all evidence your team took out of there. There's still an investigation to conduct and close. I want to see if there's any indication that Trent did this to other victims." Feltzer nodded. "Done," he said. "And another thing," Ballard said. "I go from here to BSU to get my psych exam. I want my return to duty slip expedited. You can't expect me to reach into BSU and..." "Actually, we do expect it," Towson said, cutting Feltzer off. "You tell them that you are under pressure from the chief's office to wrap this up and get Ballard back on the job because the chief wants hero cops back on the street." "Okay, okay," Feltzer said. "I'll make it all happen. But I'll need you to take that link down. Somebody could stumble across it." "It will go down when you make good on this agreement," Towson said. "Only then." Towson looked at Ballard. "We good?" he asked. "We covered everything?" "I think so," she said. "Then let's get out of here," he said. Towson said it in a tone that made his disgust clear. He stood up and looked down at Feltzer. The detective lieutenant was pale, like he had just seen his life flash in front of his eyes, or his career at least. "In a previous life, I worked JCID cases at the DA's office," Towson said. "I've still got friends over there, and they're always looking to take down guys like you, guys who let ego and power go to their heads. Don't give me a reason to pick up a phone and get reacquainted." Feltzer simply nodded. Towson and Ballard left the office and closed the door. Chapter 32. In the courtyard in front of the PAB, Ballard thanked Towson for saving her career. He said she had done that herself. "You following that reporter last night? That was genius," he said. "That's all we needed. And the beauty of it is, it will keep Feltzer in line. As long as you have that, you're in good shape." Ballard turned back to look up at the PAB. The tower of City Hall was reflected in the glass facade. "My partner on the late show. He says PAB stands for politics and bullshit," she said. "This is one of the days I think he's right." "You take care, Renee," Towson said. "Call if you need anything." "You're going to invoice me, right?" "I'll think about that. This is a situation where the accomplishment is its own reward. The look on Feltzer's face after he saw the loop? That was worth $1 million. I'm not a pro bono case counselor. Send me a bill. Just not for $1 million. All right, I will." The mention of money reminded Ballard of something. "By the way, do you have a business card?" she asked. "I'm going to recommend you to someone." "Sure do," Towson replied. He dug into his suit coat pocket and gave her a short stack of cards. "Take a few," he said. "They're free." She smiled and thanked him. "You know, I forgot to ask. Has anyone from the dancer's case come to talk to you about Fabian?" "I assume I have you to thank for that." "Yes, I was interviewed." "Who came?" "A detective named Carr." Ballard nodded. "You tell him anything you didn't already tell me?" she asked. "I don't think so," Towson said. "As I recall, you were quite thorough." Ballard smiled again, and they headed their separate ways. Towson across the courtyard toward the federal courthouse a block away, and Ballard to the steps that were to the east side of the PAB. She was pleased to hear that Carr had followed up with Towson. Maybe that meant he was also finally buying into her suggestion that a cop was involved in the shooting. At the top of the stairs, Ballard turned right and went to the memorial for fallen officers. It was a contemporary sculpture in which the names of officers killed in the line of duty were etched on brass plates and attached to a cage-like wooden edifice. Most of the brass plates had weathered over time, leaving those marking recent deaths brighter than the others. It was easy for her to pick out the brightest and shiniest plate. She stepped up and saw it had the name Ken Chastain on it. She stood there somberly for a few moments, until her phone buzzed, and she pulled it out of her back pocket. It was Rob Compton.
Renee, I just heard. What the fuck? Are you okay?
I'm good.
Why didn't you call me, baby? I just read about this in the freaking paper.
Well, don't believe everything you read. That's not the whole story, and it's going to get fixed. I didn't call you yesterday because I didn't have my phone most of the day. I finally got to it last night. What's the story with the ATF?
Never mind, that can wait. I just want to make sure you're okay.
When can we get together?
I don't want the ATF to wait, Robbie. I need to stay busy. What have you got?
She started walking down the steps and back to the courtyard. Her rental car was still in a lot behind the Times building, and she headed that way.
Well, an agent from over there called me on the weapons search we put in, Compton said. His name is John Wellborn. You know him?
I can count on one finger the number of ATF agents I know, Ballard said. I don't know him.
Do you know it's now called the ATFE? They added explosives.
Nobody calls it that. Are you going to tell me or not?
Okay. Well, this guy, Wellborn, called about the stolen Glock that Nettles had. It's got a big-time flag on it. It was taken off a Brinks guard during an armored car takedown 2 years ago in Dallas. I don't remember the case, but the guard it was taken from, he was executed with it. Same with his partner.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's what I said.
So at first they were thinking we had the guy, you know, Nettles. But Nettles was in prison at the time of this thing in Dallas. So the gun had to have been stolen a second time in one of the burglaries he committed. And probably a caper that went unreported. Because if you had a gun stolen that was used in a double murder armored car job, you wouldn't call the cops and report a burglary. You'd lie low and hope that the gun disappeared.
Right. So here's the thing. These feds, they wouldn't normally stop to ask a patrol agent shit. They'd just blow on by me. But we put these guns into the computer before we knew what was what, you know? Like, which house they were stolen from? So Wellborn's calling me up, chomping at the bit, wanting to move on this. But he can't.
Nope. He's stuck, waiting on me.
Where is Nettles? Did he get sent back up yet?
Not yet. He's still in county and scheduled to go in front of a judge tomorrow.
Ballard was quiet as she thought through the situation. She was technically relieved of duty pending the psych exam and the FID case. She wondered if she could move her BSU appointment up and get it out of the way. She would really be counting on Feltzer to come through with the forced agreement to streamline everything.
I'm supposed to be riding the pine because of this other thing, she said. But I'm hoping it clears today.
No way they clear you that quick, he said. Not with what's in the paper today.
I've got somebody working on that. We'll see.
So then, what do you want to do?
How much discretion do you have with Nettles?
Some, yeah.
It's the weapons, felon with a firearm, that's the play.
Well, I'm downtown right now. I have an appointment with behavioral and then I could clear. We could go see Nettles at county and find out if he wants to help himself by telling us where he got the Glock.
When he finds out it was used in a two-bagger, he'll probably be more than happy to disown it and tell us where it came from.
Okay, I need a couple hours myself. I have something unrelated going, and I need to clear a move like this. I don't think it'll be a problem, but I just have to follow protocol and talk to the boss about trading with Nettles. How about we meet at Men's Central at 12? That'll be lunch, and they should be able to grab him up for us.
See you then.
As Ballard headed to her car, she called Lieutenant McAdams at Hollywood Detectives.
LT, I'm not sure when or if I'll make it in today, she said.
Ballard, you're supposed to be on the bench till this FID thing clears, McAdams said.
I know, I'm down here at FID right now.
What's going on?
I got called in for more questions, and after this I go to BSU for the psych exam. I don't know how long this will take.
Did you see the Times today?
More importantly, did FID see it?
Yeah, everybody's seen the Times and it's bullshit.
Then where the fuck did it come from?
Good question, LT.
Ballard, a word to the wise?
Watch your ass.
Roger that.
The behavioral science unit was located in Chinatown. Ballard's appointment wasn't until 10:30,
so she called to see if she could get it bumped up by a half hour or more. The phone receptionist almost laughed before telling her the request could not be accommodated. With time to kill, Ballard got her car out of the pay lot and drove over to County USC. She found that Ramona was no longer in the acute care ward. She had been upgraded to fair condition, and with that came a change of rooms. She was now sharing a room with another patient. She was conscious and alert. The swelling around her eyes was way down, and the bruising had moved to the yellow-green stage. The stitches had been removed from her lower lip as well. Ballard entered the room and smiled at her, but there didn't seem to be any recognition.
"Ramona, I'm Detective Ballard. I'm assigned to your case. I came by Monday, do you remember?"
"Not really." The voice was unmistakably male. "I showed you photos, to see if one was the man who hurt you."
"I'm sorry."
"No, it's okay. In fact, it doesn't really matter now. That's why I came by, to tell you that the man who hurt you is dead. So you don't have to be afraid or worry about him anymore. He's gone."
"You sure it was him?"
"Very sure, Ramona."
"Okay."
She looked down as though she might be about to cry at the news. Ballard knew Ramona was safe now, but only from one predator. She was leading a life that was sure to bring more. Ballard pulled one of the cards she got from Towson out of her pocket and held it up.
"I wanted to give you this. This is a lawyer I've worked with, and I think he's pretty good."
"Why do I need a lawyer? What do they say I did?"
"Oh, no, nothing like that.
I'm not supposed to give out legal advice, but if I was, I would tell you that you should sue the estate of the man who did this to you. I'm pretty sure he had a large amount of money invested in his house. I think you should get a lawyer and go after some of that money. He victimized you, and you should collect from his estate before anybody else does."
"Okay."
But Ramona did not reach out for the business card. Ballard put it down on the table next to her bed. "It's right there when you need it."
"Okay, thanks.
I'm going to leave my own card too. Later on, you will probably have questions. You can give me a call."
"Okay."
It was an awkward exit, because with the case concluded by Trent's death, there was no need for Ballard to spend more time with Ramona. As she left the hospital, Ballard wondered if she would ever see her again. Perhaps, she thought, she had suggested the lawsuit against Trent's estate because she knew she would be called in to testify about the case. She wondered if it was a subconscious move to seek the kind of fulfillment that came from taking a case from beginning to end. Trent was dead, but Ballard might still be able to take him to trial and get a guilty verdict. Chapter 33. Ballard sat in an office with Dr. Carmen Hinojos, the director of the Behavioral Science Unit. The room is decorated in blonde wood, cream-colored walls and pale curtains. The window looked across the roofs of Chinatown toward the spire of City Hall. They sat facing each other in comfortably cushioned chairs that contradicted the uncomfortable situation for Ballard.
"Have you ever killed anyone before?" Hinojos asked.
"No," Ballard said. "First time."
"How are you feeling about it today?"
"To be honest, I feel fine about it. If I hadn't killed him, he would have killed me, I have no doubt." She immediately regretted starting her answer with, "to be honest." Usually when people said that, they were being anything but honest. The session continued down avenues of questioning Ballard had fully expected. As with almost every situation an officer faced regarding internal investigations and procedures, she was well-versed in what would be asked and how it should best be answered. The union newsletters carried case examples all the time that were analyzed in depth. Ballard knew that the important thing to say and project with Hinojos was that there was no second-guessing of her actions up to and including the killing of Trent. Showing regret or remorse would be wrong moves. The department needed to be assured that if returned to duty, she would not have any hesitation in doing her job, that she would not hesitate if placed in a kill-or-be-killed situation. Ballard was calm and forthright during the interview and showed discomfort only when Hinojos veered away from questions about the Trent killing to asking about her childhood and the path she took to law enforcement. Ballard began to feel like she was trapped. She had to reveal herself to a stranger, a risk that her return to duty would be delayed by further analysis or treatment. Ballard didn't want that. She didn't want to ride the pine. She tried to put a positive spin on things in terms of the good things she had learned from bad experiences. But even she knew that finding the positive in things, like her father's untimely death, her mother's abandonment of her as a teenager, and the year she spent homeless was a difficult task. Maui has the prettiest beaches in the world, Ballard said at one point. I surfed every morning before going to school.
Yes, but you had no home to go to, and a mother who didn't care, Anoho said.
No one should face that at that age. It wasn't that long. Tutu came for me.
Tutu?
Hawaiian, for grandmother. She brought me back here, to Ventura.
Panohos was an older woman with white hair and golden brown skin. She had been with the department for more than 30 years. On her lap was an open file that contained the psychological report drawn from the examination conducted when Ballard had first applied to the LAPD 15 years earlier. Much of the history was there. Ballard hadn't known enough at the time to keep her past to herself. Ballard had not been back to BSU since that initial exam.
Dr. Richardson has an interesting workup here, Hinojo said, referring to the initial examiner. He says disorder in your young life drew you to law enforcement, a job where you enforce laws and enforce order. What do you think about that?
Well, Ballard said, stalling, I think we need to have rules. They are what makes society civilized.
And Thomas Trent broke the rules, didn't he?
Yes, big time.
If you had the chance to relive the past 72 hours and make smarter choices, do you think Thomas Trent would still be alive?
I don't know about smarter choices. I think I made the right choice in the moment. I would prefer answering questions about what did happen and why, not speculation about what could have happened or what could have been.
So no regrets then?
Sure, I have regrets, but not for what you probably think.
Try me.
What regrets?
Don't get me wrong, I had no choice. It was him or me. In that situation, I have zero regrets. And if faced with the same circumstances, I would do what I did again. But I do wish he were still alive, so I could arrest him, and we could take him to trial, and he would rot in prison for what he did.
You believe that by being stabbed and losing his life, he got off easy?
Ballard thought for a moment and then nodded.
Yeah, I do.
Hinojos closed the file.
Okay, Detective Ballard, thank you for your candor, she said.
Wait, that's it? Ballard asked.
That's it.
Well, do I get the RTD?
That will be forthcoming, but I am going to suggest that you take some time off to recuperate mentally. You have been through a trauma, and there are unanswered questions about what happened to you when you were drugged. Your mind is bruised as well as your body. Like the body, the mind needs time to heal. It needs time to settle from this.
I appreciate that, Doctor, I really do, but I have active cases. I need to wrap them up, and then I can take time off.
Hinojo smiled in a tired sort of way, as if she had heard what Ballard said 1,000 times before.
I guess all cops come in here and say the same thing, Ballard said.
I can't blame them, Hinojo said. They are worried about losing their jobs and identities, not worried about the consequence both have on them.
What would you do if you were not a police officer?
Ballard thought for a moment.
I don't know, she said. I haven't thought about it.
Hinojo nodded.
I've done this a long time, she said. I've seen long careers and careers cut short. The difference is in how you handle the darkness.
The darkness? Ballard said.
I work the late show. There is nothing but...
I'm talking about the darkness within.
You have a job, detective, that takes you into the bleakest side of the human soul. Into the darkness of people like Trent. To me, it's like the laws of physics. For every action, there is an opposite and equal reaction. If you go into darkness, the darkness goes into you. You then have to decide what to do with it. How to keep yourself safe from it. How to keep it from hollowing you out.
She paused there, and Ballard knew not to speak.
Find something that protects you, Detective Ballard.
Hinojos got up from her chair then, and the session was over. She walked Ballard to the room's door. Ballard nodded a goodbye.
Thank you, Doctor.
Stay safe, Detective Ballard.
Chapter 34.
Ballard was 20 minutes late getting to Men's Central Jail, but Compton was there, waiting for her. They signed in and Ballard stowed her backup gun in a locker before they were placed in an interview room to wait while Christopher Nettles was located and brought to them.
How are we going to do this? Ballard asked.
Let me do the talking, Compton said. He knows I'm the one with the power. I filed on him with a gun. That's our currency.
Sounds like a plan.
While they waited, Compton reached over and lifted Ballard's hands, and somberly studied the bandages on her wrists.
I know. It looks like I tried to end it all, she said.
I'll only need the bandages for a week.
The bastard, Compton said. I'm just glad you put him down. Ballard told Compton the short version of what had happened with Trent, and how an illegal leak to the Times had bent the story against her. Compton shook his head. Ballard decided not to tell him about how the rough sex they had had Saturday morning had hindered the ability of the RTC nurse to determine if she had been raped. That discussion could keep for another time. The conversation, as it was, ended when the door opened and Nettles was escorted in by two jail deputies. He immediately objected to the presence of Ballard, claiming that she had mistreated him during his arrest. "Sit down and shut up," Compton said sternly. "You don't get to decide things like that." The deputies put him in a chair and locked one of his wrists to a steel ring at the center of the table. "So what do you want?" Nettles said. Compton waited until the deputies stepped out. "Do you have any idea about your situation, Christopher?" he asked. "You're going up in front of a judge tomorrow. Has a lawyer been by to talk to you?" "Not yet," Nettles said. He flicked his cuffed hand in a gesture that suggested he wasn't worried. "Well, the reason you haven't seen a lawyer is that a lawyer isn't going to be able to help you," Compton said. "Your parole has been revoked, and you're going back up to Corcoran, and there isn't a damn thing a lawyer can do about it." "I only had a bullet left," Nettles said. "I can do that, no sweat off my balls." He looked at Ballard as he said it. Ballard knew that the bullet was a year in the pen. "And what, you think the DA is going to just let all those burglaries slide?" Compton asked. "What I hear people saying in here is that all the DA will do is stack them right next to my current situation, and I won't do an extra day on account of overcrowding," Nettles said. "How about that?" "Then how about the felon with a gun charge I just added to your resume? That's 5 years stacked on top of the bullet. You can do that? No sweat off your balls?" "The fuck you talking about, man?" "I'm talking about a plus five." "That's bullshit." Nettles shook his cuff violently. He pointed his free hand at Ballard. "This is because of you, bitch," he yelled. "Don't blame me for your crimes," Ballard threw back at him. "Blame yourself." Ballard kept her hands on her lap and below the table. She was wearing a long-sleeved blouse, but she didn't want to risk Nettles seeing the bandages around her wrists and asking questions. "Look, Christopher, why do you think we're here?" Compton said. "You think we get off on giving you the bad news?" "Probably," Nettles said. "She does." "Actually, you're wrong," Compton said. "We're not here to bring bad news. We're the light at the end of your tunnel. We came to help you help yourself." Nettles settled down. He knew there was a deal to be made now. He looked suspiciously at Compton. "What do you want?" he asked. "I want to know about the guns," Compton said. "I want to know where you stole them from. I want addresses, details. You give me that, and we start subtracting from the total, you see?" Ballard appreciated that Compton was not directly asking about the Glock. It was better not to reveal their specific intention to Nettles. The ex-con might then attempt to manipulate the interview. "I don't know, man," Nettles whined. "How am I supposed to remember addresses?" "Think," Compton said. "You must have some idea what houses you hit. Start with the gun you were carrying, the Glock Model 17. You must have liked it, because you didn't pawn it. Where'd that come from?" Nettles leaned forward and put the elbow of his free arm down on the table. He used his free hand to work his jaw like the thinker as he considered the question. "Well, first of all three of those guns came from the same house," he finally said. "I just don't remember the fucking address. Don't you people get burglary reports for these things?" Compton ignored the question. "What about the street?" he asked. "Do you remember the street name?" "No, I don't remember any street name," Nettles said. Ballard had connected six of the credit cards found in Nettles' room at the Siesta Village with burglary reports where no firearms were reported as taken. This meant those victims had either lied about the guns or there was at least one burglary committed by Nettles that was not reported, most likely because a murder weapon had been stolen. The six known cases had all been located on streets a few blocks from the Siesta Village, creating a pattern extending north, east, and west from the motel. There was no freeway or other impediment to accessing the neighborhood south of the motel, and yet none of the known burglaries had occurred there. This told Ballard that the house they were looking for might be south. "Did you ever hit any houses south of the motel where you were staying?" Ballard asked. "South," Nettles responded. "Yeah, I hit south." Compton threw her a look. She wasn't supposed to ask the questions, but she continued the line of inquiry. "Okay, how many times did you go south?"
"Once or twice."
The houses that way weren't as nice. People had junk.
When did you hit down there?
When I first started.
Okay.
According to the motel, you had been there 9 years.